Hi, everybody, and welcome to Mecha Dragon, a podcast about all the geeky and nerdy stuff you love. Brought to you by Captain Geek and the Dark Nerd. I'm your Captain, Will.
And I'm your nerd, Jess.
Today, we're talking about the future of the MCU after we go through a few further thoughts on Avengers Endgame, because, frankly, when we did our Endgame review, I literally walked out of the movie theater, came home, turned on my microphone, called up Jess here, and we recorded that. So in some ways, it was really more of a, you know, initial reaction. So we are going to have some further thoughts, but I need to mention that we are also privileged to have two guests here on the show today. In no particular order, we have Jay Scherer, who is the host of the Story Geeks podcast, one of my personal favorites, and author of the critically acclaimed Time Slingers, now available at Amazon. And so we're very glad to have you on, Jay. Hi.
Hey, it's great to be here. I love your guys' podcast, too, and it's good to join you and talk some more about Avengers Endgame. I've been talking about Avengers Endgame a lot, so it's always a pleasure to talk about it some more.
Great. I'm excited to have you here. Yeah, it seems like those conversations are never ending, aren't they? also, we have with us Eric Hansen, a film critic whose articles appear at screenhub.com and who's a script reader for International Screenwriters Association. Hi, Eric.
Hello, hello, Will. Pleasure to be here.
It's really good to have you guys both here to get some extra point of views on this. So I would like to begin, like I said, with some further thoughts on Endgame. And really, it was just this past Tuesday that we had the home video release in terms of being able to buy the, you know, the discs and watch the special features on the discs at home. So why don't we actually start with the thoughts about the movie itself and then move on to you know, any thoughts we might have about the special features. So really, I just want to get started with our guests. So why don't we start with Jay? What are your thoughts on Endgame now that it's had some time to sort of simmer a little while?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think Endgame, it's always felt to me like the perfect culmination of, what are we in, phase four of the MCU. It is everything that the MCU is, like, dialed up to 11. Like, it's ridiculous, right? And it's sort of a perfect culmination to all of these things. So for me, I really enjoyed it. Now, I will say simultaneously that any problems that I have with the MCU are also true about Avengers Endgame, right? So so I think that it's not my favorite film. It's probably just outside my top five MCU films. But it's still a pretty magnificent achievement given what we've had thus far in these amazing movies.
I couldn't agree more. It's funny you mention where it rates for you, you know, just outside the top five, because I have such a hard time rating this movie because it feels so different from all the other ones in a way, since it is such a conclusion, which really I don't think you can say any of the other movies are a conclusion in this way, right? So that part's interesting.
Absolutely.
Eric, what can you say sort of generally about how you feel about this game now that you've been able to sit with it for a little while longer?
Well, with me, I don't really consider Endgame its own movie. I consider this and Infinity War to be like one big long epic. And because of that, I mean, essentially Endgame is the second half of, you know, the story that was started in Infinity War. And I actually liked it a lot better than Infinity War. I didn't hate Infinity War. I really liked it. But I felt Endgame was more streamlined as far as the story went, since the cast was smaller. It would allow, you know, a greater attention on all the characters that were still involved in the movie. And I liked that they dialed back the action a little bit, so they put a little bit more focus on character development, and then they had that big final, you know, set piece at the end of the movie. Right. And that they had some smaller scale action, like when Captain America fights himself. I thought that was a terrific scene, and I tend to like smaller scale action set pieces, so that I really enjoyed. And, I liked a lot of the callbacks to previous movies that I actually hadn't even seen yet. Like, I still haven't seen all of the Captain America movies. I've seen the first two.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Like, one of the things you'll learn about me is I've seen pretty much every film series out of sequence except for The Terminator and Predator, and that's it. Like, oh, okay. All other movie series, Indiana Jones, Star Wars, Star Trek, Friday the 13th, Halloween, seen them all out of sequence. So seeing a series out of sequence, it's nothing new to me. But I think Endgame is probably my favorite of all the films with the main cast per se.
Okay.
My favorite thing in the MCU is Guardians of the Galaxy, but
yeah, same. I love Guardians of the Galaxy.
I think that one is the number one spot on my list as well for the MCU, because you know when Guardians of the Galaxy came out, it just hit me full in the face with like its energy and the life of it. And you know, I remember sitting there when the title card came up and Star-Lord's dancing to that song in the very beginning, like I just felt like a kid again, you know.
I mean, my favorite MCU films are the ones that are different. I like the ones that break from the formula. And Endgame really did break from the formula because it's not that heavy on action until I think until the final act. A lot of that, you know, before then is character development. You know, and it's funny because the parts that people quote, the parts that have, you know, become part of the pop culture lexicon are the quiet moments, are the character moments, you know, like I Love You 3000. Right. That's not an action scene. It's this cute little character moment. I think it shows that, you know, I think film audiences are underrated in how well they can appreciate good character development. And I think the fact that, you know, Endgame has been such a big success, in spite of the fact that comparatively the amount of action in it is a bit less than, you know, other Marvel films. I think that shows that, you know, people still are interested in good character development when it comes to movies.
I couldn't agree more. So, Jess, what are your further thoughts on Endgame now that you've been able to sit with it for a while?
I've seen it, I don't know, probably 7 times now. My kids are kind of on Endgame fatigue. It's like I got the Blu-ray and was going to put it in. We're going to watch all the special effects. And that's like, let's watch it again. They're like, no. but no, I think it is true that like the first half of the movie, there's no action at all, and it is mainly on, you know, character development and stuff, and that's real important because not only are there storylines to tie up, but there's a lot of emotional stuff. You know, we've become attached to these characters in over the years in a lot of ways, and takes some time to really find closure with, you know, our favorite heroes. And just seeing the epic scope of the film together and all of the possible ways they could have screwed up and like left plot holes here and there, they really did a great job of making a mostly seamless production that really hit all the right notes, filled all the holes, and gave us mostly what we all wanted to see. So I think it's one of my top 3.
Well, I think it's amazing how well it was able to do all of those things. I mean, if you consider what a huge undertaking it was with so many stars and everything else, you know.
In a mere 3 hours.
In a mere 3 hours and 1 minute and 11 seconds, yeah.
It's the Lawrence of Arabia of superhero movies.
Exactly.
I never thought of it that way. That's great. You know,
with the dust.
You know, one of the things that really stuck out to me a lot, like in my most recent watch through of it, was I don't know whether it's because I was like less focused on some of the other character arcs because I had already seen it a few times, but I was very, very aware of Natasha's arc through this movie this time, and especially how desperate she was in that scene where she's having like the virtual like conference call with everybody.
Right.
Where she's basically, you know, trying to get like the, you know, the mission reports from them, but there's really nothing going on. But she's, you know, just trying so hard to hold on to this family and this job and this thing that has meant so much to her. And then later, you know, once they finally do have a plan and they're moving on that plan, how much happier she sees. She was almost like the happiest character, except for maybe the Hulk, because he's kind of become his like best self in this movie, you know, as a result of the events of Infinity War. But like, yeah, you know,
this is actually my first exposure to Professor Hulk, because I actually haven't read the comics. I'm not that big a comic guy. So a lot of the ideas and characters introduced in these movies are totally new to me. But, you know, as a newcomer to Marvel, you know, I quite enjoyed Professor Hulk.
Oh, I thought he was great. And I love how he is a little bit of a mix. And he's not quite Banner, you know. He's Smart Hulk, but he's not quite Banner. He's, like, way more confident and assertive than Banner was.
Less mousy.
But he's still but he's still got that doofiness, you know, that Banner had.
Right.
But just one last thing that I was saying is, like, you know, that scene in the spaceship, the Benatar, when Black Widow and Hawkeye are traveling towards Vormir, they have that moment where they're like grinning at each other like idiots. And even though they know, you know, the seriousness of this mission and everything, I mean, they don't know exactly what to expect on Vormir. But it just really jumped out at me how important all this was to her character. And I guess I was just paying more attention to her arc this time through.
Yeah, it's like her and Clint, you know, they have such a history together and, you know, they were so close in a lot of ways. So I think both of them kind of felt, even though they're heading towards who knows what end, I think they were just relieved to have their old partner back at their side, you know?
That
someone
too.
Someone they could trust.
That too, for sure. I mean, they're out of the, you know, at least Hawkeye's darkest times so far. But, you know, we brought up this new character of Professor Hulk, or, you know, some people are calling him Smart Hulk. So let me put this to Eric and then Jay.
I thought he was called Professor Hulk in the comics, wasn't he? Because that's what
I
heard.
Yeah, he is, and they just, I don't think they really referred to him much by, I mean, Rocket called him Big Green. Nobody in the movie called him Professor
Hulk. Yeah, I don't
think
Hulk, he was so, given the official name.
Yeah, they don't call him that in the movie, but that's like his official name in the comics.
Right, so my bad. That's just kind of what I've been calling him because that was kind of the designation from the comics. Not that I read all those ones, by the way, but like, what
right.
did you
oh,
like
so
about
you and
that?
You're in the same boat then.
Yeah. So, but Eric, like, what did you like about that character and what spoke to you about it? And then we'll get Jay's take on the Smart Hulk.
Well, to me, it kind of like added an extra dimension to the Hulk character, you know, to see these two individuals merged. So you had like the brute force of the Hulk, but with, you know, Banner's kind of gentle demeanor and, you know, quiet intellectualism, and to see this kind of big monstrosity with a personality so unapologetically sweet and good natured. So that spoke to me a lot. I like characters that are big and imposing, but at the same time, they're marshmallows. I mean, you have Iron Giant, for example, that's a classic example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I thought it added, you know, kind of a greater challenge when it came to animating the character, because, you know, there's a lot more complexity in how to, like, create all these emotions
with his
character.
Oh, and his microfacial expressions and everything, yeah.
Yeah, because he's definitely a lot more multidimensional than, you know, the classic depiction of the Hulk. So, and to kind of see that character brought to life in a way that, man, I believed it. I mean, you could tell it's pixels, but you still feel it. You know, you still feel the emotion that's there, and mm-hmm. I thought it was a really interesting way to kind of like show the development of the character, and it wasn't what I was expecting, because I was expecting, you know, him to Hulk out and get his revenge on Thanos, and instead the character kind of exploits the greatest thing about himself, which isn't his brute force, it's his brain. And that I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Jay, what are your thoughts on this new version of the Hulk in Endgame?
I like the way that Eric put his thoughts. It's funny, though, because I don't really like Professor Hulk, Smart Hulk. I've even heard him called Sexy Hulk, of all things. But my issue with his character is less about how he's used. I think he's used fine in Endgame, and it's actually kind of a cool place for him to be. My issue is more in the fact that we haven't really seen the Hulk developed, because I guess the fact is they don't really have the rights to make their own Hulk movies, like standalone right. Hulk movies. And I think that creates a really big problem for him, because all these other characters are going through arcs in their own movies, but the Hulk has to go through arcs in like side films. And then I think when we see him, it's like, well, we see Hulk and we see him and he's in Infinity War, and the Hulk doesn't even want to come out. And then the very next time you see him, it's like, oh no, I worked it all out. And it's like, oh, I want to see that movie. I want to see that movie where you work it all out. That sounds amazing. That's why I think I missed a little bit. And so I just see him and I go, okay, that's fine. But what I really want is this dynamic that is, he's out of control. He is a rage monster. And a person learning to deal with that rage and learning to control that rage is a fascinating story, but it's really told to us in like 5 seconds. Oh, yeah, I dealt with that problem. I'm good to go. So that's my only.
And that movie that you just described, where he gets through all of that to where he can become the Smart Hulk, like, I would definitely watch that, the heck out of that movie.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think Jess and I were saying in our initial review of this movie that that's something that we really missed in Endgame 2, was like, wait, we didn't get to see how he sort of gets to
where,
this point.
Where was Hulk at? Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is true. We haven't seen a standalone Hulk movie since the Edward Norton film.
Right. Right.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can blame Universal for that, I guess.
Universal.
Yeah.
Then again, I'm glad we
did Jaws 4. I'll never forgive you for that.
I'm glad we don't have Ed Norton as Hulk now.
Yeah. Ruffalo is definitely a lot better. Ruffalo is definitely better.
I think I do like Ruffalo better, though. I have to say, at the time, I was very interested in the casting choice of Edward Norton, and I thought he did fine in that movie. But I love
Ed too. But
I think it is one of the weaker offerings of the MCU, though, as you know, taken as a whole.
I mean, I would equate it to the Jack Ryan movies, because I think Jack Ryan, he's been played by four different actors so far in the films. You had Alec Baldwin in the first one. Harrison Ford played him twice, and then you had Ben Affleck and Chris Pine. Now, my favorite Jack Ryan is Alec Baldwin, because he feels like the guy who they plucked out of a back office and got whisked off on this wild adventure. Whereas you watch Harrison Ford, you're like, oh, he's an action hero. Whereas the whole point of Jack Ryan and that Jack Ryan is that he's not supposed to be an action hero. He's a guy who's in over his head. And with Baldwin, I bought that more.
And the other thing I love about the Alec Baldwin Jack Ryan is that he does a killer Sean Connery impression.
And he's got those sweet, sweet sweaty balls.
Right. Some things don't react well to bullets.
Right.
But, I mean, that's the same way I felt about, you know, Ruffalo versus Norton. I like Norton. Like, I hadn't heard of Mark Ruffalo before, you know, he appeared in The Avengers, and I was a big fan of Edward Norton. But Ruffalo seems like a more accurate depiction of Banner than Norton. Like, Norton didn't feel like the kind of geeky scientist that Ruffalo would do so well.
Yeah, right. I agree. You know, back to the movie more as a whole, as opposed to this one character, one of the other things that I've thought more and more about the more time that has gone on about this movie is, like, it really does seem to be this amazing exploration of loss and grief and failure and, like, how that affects you and
sacrifice.
how you can work through it or, you know, get beyond it. And I think that it's very apparent in Thor, right? And I love the, what do they call him now? Bro Thor.
I just call him Dude Thor, because I mean,
Thor.
Tony Stark straight up calls him Lebowski at one point, which I loved.
Yeah, right. That was the best joke. That was so great. But how do you guys feel?
Is he looking at us? I think he's dead.
Yeah. So how do you guys feel about that? Not only Thor, but we definitely should talk about Thor. But, you know, just this idea that, because, you know, for the first, like, at least third of the movie, you're just kind of adrift in this loss and, like, sadness of it. And, you know, it's very, I think you were saying before, Eric, it's, like, very sort of filled with these character moments where we get to see, you know, how they've reacted to this, both immediately after the snap and then 5 years later. So what are your thoughts on that, Jay?
Oh, I think it's done really, really well. And I think that they took some risks with characters that I didn't expect them to take either. Like, if you look at the end of Infinity War, you could draw a direct conclusion that Thor would end up looking like what he ends up looking like in Endgame, but exactly. You would never expect them to actually do that, right? Like,
right.
So I think that was a wonderful way to take that character, especially a character who keeps learning, like, how arrogance is, like, not the best thing to put forth to the world. And then we see him there and we're like, wow, this is a totally new look for him. Also really liked the fact where they took Tony and that whole character journey. But some of those early moments where you've got, how would Captain America deal with this, right? Like, how would he deal with this, you know, 5 years out? Everything is pretty brutal for him, and he's still maintaining hope. That's pretty awesome. I think Natasha does an amazing job. And not only does an amazing job, but Scarlett Johansson in that performance, I think it's the best acting she's done, and because she was given quite a bit to do with it. She really is hurt in this film. So, yeah, I think that is a great place for us to start out. I mean, honestly, like, and I know this is in the commentary too, but they were going to end Infinity War with the Hawkeye scene. I think it's genius that they start this film with the Hawkeye scene.
Absolutely.
It sets the tone immediately. So
absolutely agree. And, you know, since you brought it up, you know, I thought I totally agree with you on that. But they also said in the commentary that actually when Banner was in the Hulkbuster fighting Obsidian, whatever his name is, sorry, that one Maul. Big guy, Obsidian Maul. Yeah. Thank you. When he was fighting Obsidian Maul, he originally the Hulk did bust out at that point. And then there was going to be like this moment where he came out of the foliage and saw, you know, Black Widow, and she was, and she said, you know, the sun's getting real low. And he was like, oh no, we don't need that anymore, you know, because he had in that moment made his peace. But they explained in the commentary that it felt like this weird triumphant thing at the end when they were just losing and losing and losing. And so I'm actually really glad that they changed it so that we don't see the Fused or the Smart Hulk until Endgame, even though I would have loved to see the movie or the, you know, the scenes where he actually goes through that journey.
Yeah, totally.
Right.
So, Eric, what are your thoughts about, you know, this topic of Endgame dealing with loss and, you know, and failure?
I mean, each character pretty much encompasses the you know, the number of new unique ways you can deal with loss and failure. Like, you know, Thor is obviously, you know, gripped between a nasty two-pronged hit of you know, both self-pity and guilt, and it's completely wrecked him. You know, Captain America, he still seems to be devoted to helping others. He's less focused on himself and more focused on, you know, helping others kind of deal with their loss. That's one of the reasons I really like that bit where he's in that therapy group kind of helping these people deal with their issues. And
yeah.
And but I think the character that, you know, probably grew the most is Tony, because he became probably the best version of himself due to this failure, because he's settled down, started a family, he's unselfishly caring for, you know, his daughter. And because of that, you know, he has a greater sense of, there's greater stakes for him on the second round here. And I think that's one of the reasons he fights so much harder in this movie. Not that he didn't fight hard in Infinity War, but this one he has...
Sure.
You know, something of much greater value to sacrifice.
I think that there was
for.
Something so important about that, you know, scene when they're back in 1970 and he meets his father, right? And then right almost at the end of that sequence, his father says, you know, he makes a comment about, oh, if it was a girl, that'd be nice because they wouldn't turn out just like me. And he says, why? And Howard responds, you know, something to the effect of, let's just say my own self-interest has never outweighed the greater good. Man, I think that hit Tony hard, actually, in that moment.
And then, of course, we get a nice, amazing Michael Douglas cameo. Great de-aging on him, by the way. It looks great.
That de-aging has gotten amazing.
If they want to do another Romancing the Stone movie, you know, they're good to go.
Wow, that'd be interesting. Yeah, so let's just let's take the conversation real quick to Thor, because I think we all agree that this new Thor is actually kind of awesome. And yeah. I have to say that I like actually relate to Thor now in a way, you know, I mean, not just because, you know, I'm kind of a little overweight and stuff like that, but also, you know, like we were saying, he's been totally wrecked by everything that's happened. He totally failed. He let the universe down. He let his own people down. His homeland's been destroyed. I mean, there's probably only like an eighth of the Asgardians left from, you know, from Dark World times. It seems like.
Right. Yeah, and he's lost, you know, Asgard. He's lost half the people before the snapping, before the blip, you know, and he feels like he's failed there, too.
It's also a major culture shock because, you know, he has to, you know, deal with this group of people that are now strangers in a strange land, that a lot of the stuff they're familiar with, landmarks and the kind of, like, mystical surroundings they had from Asgard, you know, those are all gone. They have to deal with a world that's a lot more mundane, that's a bit more harsh, perhaps. And, you know, to deal with that, you know, he's obviously going to relate very closely with these people because he had to go through the same thing in his standalone films. And that's one of the really interesting things about him, because I think Thor, all of the characters in the movie have to deal with a lot of pressure. I think Thor may have to deal with the most pressure because he's trying to take care of so many people to the point that he's really neglecting himself.
Right.
Well, I think that he's just checked out by the time we see him in Endgame. You know, because doesn't Valkyrie say...
He's like a crappy landlord of New Asgard, you know. He just stays in his house and plays Fortnite with his friends all day and drinks beer while everyone else is outside, you know, working on getting things built back up and put back together.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just felt like this great affinity for Thor in this movie. I think this might even be my favorite Thor. But also, I love...
He gets better every show.
Yeah, well, I think so. But, you know, the other thing is kind of going back to the way that this movie deals with not just loss and failure, but sort of this journey to kind of get through it. you know, when he's back, and by the way, I still love that scene with him and his mother when he travels back to Asgard.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But when he, you know, holds his hand out and he gets Mjolnir back, when it, you know, comes into his hand, you know, his smile in that moment is amazing, because it just, I feel like it in a way, it's kind of a statement that, like, yeah, you can be depressed and you can make mistakes, but that doesn't make you any less worthy of a, you know, of a person.
Right.
And that's something that really spoke to me as well. Does anybody have any?
Well, you could just, like you said, that smile on his face, that's like when he realized, you know, he does have a reason to feel self-worth again and to not give up. And I think that was really the turning point that drove him towards the rest of the movie, because it was like after that he seemed like more motivated and, you know, less Lebowski.
Yeah, I think it was between the, you know, the Mjolnir showing that he was, you know, worthy again, and, you know, the talk that he had with his mother. I think those were two big things. Yeah.
And I'd like to point out, you know, with Mjolnir, you know, just how effective a visual statement that is. Because a lot of times in a lot of the scripts I read, people try to, you know, explore emotional themes in very big speeches and shouting matches that are melodramatic and, you know, overwrought. And just the action of Thor being able to pick up that hammer says so much about who he is and who he still has the potential to be. I mean, never underestimate the power of, you know, visuals when it comes to film.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's also a testament to the just the saga that is the MCU, right? Because if you had not seen any Thor movies before this, you wouldn't necessarily get that from that visual moment, you know? I mean, you know, maybe you know something about the comics or whatever it is, but I just think that there's so many moments like that that, you know, that mean different things and have different tones in this movie, but that sort of rely on this previous knowledge that people have from all the previous movies. And I've long said that one of my favorite things about the MCU in general is just how they are weaving all of these stories together in such an interconnected way that, you know, previously really only would happen in comic books.
Right.
You know, some Marvel movies I'd like less than others and more than others, right? But
exactly.
But I just love this tapestry that they've been weaving.
Yeah, and like with Thor, I think Eric was one mentioned earlier, he hasn't watched, you know, all 22 movies in sequence. And
right.
Focusing on Thor specifically, if you watched the MCU movies backwards, by the end, I think Thor would be everyone's least favorite character, because he was so blah and boring and nothing. But Chris and the writers have done so much in making him just one of the powerhouses of the humor, you know, in the movies. And he's a great character.
I think we got to hand it to Taika Waititi.
They force-fed him the most bitter slice of humble pie imaginable. And it's definitely,
definitely
helped him grow.
Yeah.
I mean, being Jeff Goldblum's slave will do that to a man.
I always like to think of Ragnarok. I just call that Jeff Goldblum the movie, because let's face it, he's the real star of that movie.
Goldblum the movie.
I mean, being a slave would kind of suck, but being Jeff Goldblum's slave, kind of cool.
Yeah.
And as long as he doesn't pull out the melt stick.
Right.
The melt stick. You know what? That was a great scene where he's like, that's not a capital offense. Why do we have the glow stick? All right.
Speaking of Goldblum, more people need to see Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Everybody forgets he's in that. He's so good in that movie.
This, like, the 1978 version?
Yeah, the 1978. It's him, Donald Sutherland, Leonard Nimoy.
Oh my
he's
God.
So good.
That movie is one of the movies that scared me the most in my life. I'll tell you that. So, but back to Endgame, Jay, is there anything else that, like, really has, that's really been on your mind with regard to Endgame, you know, once you've, you know, been kind of thinking about it since it's come out?
Oh, man. First of all, I think what Endgame does is, not only does it close out 22 movies really, really well, it does set up the next group of movies or TV shows really well, too. I would have told you that I was getting pretty tired of Thor, since we're talking about Thor. I would have told you I was getting pretty tired of him. Like, you know, like, I did appreciate what Taika Waititi did with the character, but at the same time, he didn't move the character forward like the Russo brothers did here. And so I go, okay, now that's an interesting character for me. Same thing with Hawkeye. I am fascinated with Hawkeye now and can't wait to see the Hawkeye series after Endgame. I don't think I would have said that beforehand. Yeah. So I think one of the things that Endgame does is it kind of sets you up to go, okay, well, what's next? I can't wait for the next Guardians of the Galaxy. That's been consistently awesome. With James Gunn back on, that's a huge win. So, yeah, no, I think it sets everything up. So I haven't really been reflecting on it so much from a standpoint of saying, like, well, do I have to process that still? Now I've started to just move on to, well, what's coming next, you know?
Well, that's a good point.
It's like Endgame. Yeah. Game on.
That's right.
Yeah. So why don't we just take a second to talk about the special features on the disc really quick before we move into everything. So I watched everything on the discs.
Which I'm afraid I haven't seen yet, so I'll be sitting this one out real quick.
Well, that's fine, because really the only things I have to say about it are, one, you know, the gag reel's kind of funny, but honestly, I don't even normally watch the gag reel on the special features of movies that I get. You know, there's really not that much to it. It's just a few funny moments from your, you know, favorite actors from these franchises. The deleted scenes were interesting. There is one where Rocket kind of has a funny joke about, like, how they could have defeated the Chitauri that invaded New York, like, a lot easier. But other than that, I mean, you could totally see why they didn't include all of those scenes. And the featurettes were fun. I mean, there's the great, they have the same little, like, Stan Lee in memoriam thing that they aired when they re-released Avengers to beat Avatar's box office. And that was kind of nice. But really what I want to mention is the commentary. And we already talked about a couple of the things from the commentary, the fact that they were going to originally put that scene with Hawkeye's family at the end of Infinity War, which, like, how brilliant is it that they put it at the beginning of Endgame, right? Like you said, Jay, because I think it also reacquaints us, you know, the audience with what happened and what the stakes truly are, right? And then also, and they did mention this in the commentary, when his wife calls him after Hulk snaps everybody back, I don't think that moment would have had as much impact if we didn't actually see them dusted away at the beginning of this movie.
Right.
But the main thing that I wanted to bring up, and this is part of how the conclusion of Endgame sets up what's to come, is Joe Russo, during that big climactic fight sequence when Scarlet Witch comes out, Wanda comes out, and she really almost defeats Thanos, like, right then and there. I mean, she's perhaps the most powerful person on that entire field, right? He said something like the development of her powers is very much tied to her internal state and her emotions. And he said something like the loss of vision really accelerated the growth of her powers. And so what that made me think of is, you know, there's this WandaVision show that's coming out. And my thought is, well, is she going through the stages of grief here? And how is that going to manifest in her powers? Right? Like, so, you know, at first in Infinity War, she's kind of in denial. She doesn't even want to talk about sacrificing vision to, you know, stop this whole thing, you know, and then she actually does it, and she's very angry. So, like, in Endgame, when she's confronting Thanos, she's extremely angry. So I'm wondering if she's going to get to this point where it's like she's having trouble dealing with it. Does she get to a bargaining stage where she's thinking back and she, you know, really wishes she could find him again, and that results in her powers, like, opening a tear in, like, the multiverse, and that's how Vision reemerges in her show? I mean, what do you guys think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't thought that much about it, but I was wondering, you know, why couldn't Vision be brought back without the stone? You know, basically, he's Jarvis mixed with, I guess, Ultron. But certainly, Tony had a backup, an external hard drive somewhere. I'm sure there's a backup of Vision on a drive that, because he's basically a, you know, he's a being, but he's also powered by, you know, data and stuff, and he could be downloaded and uploaded again and rebooted.
What does data from the Goonies have to do with this?
Well, I'm trying to cross cultures here, you know, mix things in. Okay. But, yeah, that's an interesting look on, I'm curious about WandaVision show.
I get it,
too.
Since Data was in the Goonies and Brand became Thanos, it all makes sense now.
That's right.
Yep, we're all 6 degrees from Thanos.
That's right. Wow, Josh Brolin's come a long way, hasn't he?
Well, one thing I think the MCU has done really, really well is deal with characters reacting to significant events in their life that have caused them to be in experiencing grief in a really intense way. In fact, there's some films that are just basically dedicated to moving a character through the reaction to the trauma that they experienced in the last film, right?
Right.
Which I think is really fascinating. And I think that having Wanda go through that process in a TV show is a really solid call. I would not have told you that, again, this is why Endgame sets some things up. Well, Endgame and Infinity War. I like Eric's take that it's all sort of one film. The fact that we are more sympathetic to Wanda, because I don't know if I would have felt sympathetic to Wanda prior to Infinity War. So they've set this up really well to you know, catapult us to the next thing. Otherwise, I don't know if I would have cared about what was going to happen with Wanda next. You know, I would have said just like, let's just jump into like House of M or something from the comics and then just skip ahead. But I think this is really good. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, same. Now, since we're already talking about WandaVision, I just want to mention a couple details about it, and then we can kind of go through the rest of the future of the MCU, what's known, what's, you know, rumored, and so on. But so supposedly WandaVision is scheduled to come out on Disney Plus, their new streaming service, in spring of 2021. It's starring Elizabeth Olsen, Paul Bettany, Tiana Paris as adult Monica Rambeau. I remember Lieutenant Trouble from Captain Marvel. So, and Vision is confirmed to return, and they showed like a little teaser at San Diego Comic-Con where it looked like Wanda and Vision were in like a 1950s timeline. So that's all just really interesting, right? And so that's kind of, that was the other thing that made me think, well, what if, you know, she opens up, you know, a hole in the multiverse, or that is a result of how she uses her powers, you know, in her grief. But the other thing,
she gets the stones again,
or if they do or if they do some more Back to the Future Part Two stuff, which is another thing I really liked about Endgame, how they kind of did what Back to the Future Part Two did, where they allowed you to kind of like re-explore some of the best moments from the earlier movies, but from like a new perspective.
Yeah,
which was one of my favorite things about, Back to the Future Part Two, and you know, all the little kind of in jokes they add in, like I love the little dig at the whole Hail Hydra thing from the comics, because you know that was, that whole moment was supposedly a parody of that moment, and you think you're going to get to see that amazing elevator fight scene again, and instead it ends on a very funny joke.
And not only is it funny, that's a big character moment for Cap too, right? Because he's evolved.
He learns to be deceitful. He fucking lies, and it's
great. Well, he doesn't have to solve everything with his fists anymore, you know?
He is now complete.
Yes. So, but just going with the WandaVision thing, so it, May 7th, 2021, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness is coming out. They have announced this. Now, Feige has said that, I believe it was Feige who said, that the events of WandaVision will lead directly into the new Doctor Strange movie. They've announced that it's starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Elizabeth Olsen.
Which apparently is going to be like very Lovecraftian, from what I understand, because I've always been a big fan of Lovecraft's work.
The director, Scott Derrickson, who's also writing it, has said that he wants to make the first scary MCU film. And I really hope they lean into the Lovecraftian sort of horror of it. I really do. But all of this makes me wonder, and I want to hear what you guys think about this. Is it possible that Wanda could even be some type of antagonist in this movie? I mean, they did it with Tony Stark in Civil War. I mean, he was technically the antagonist of that movie.
Well, I mean, what are her loyalties towards? I mean, I'm assuming Vision's going to be involved in the show, so maybe she has to do some dastardly deeds to get back the love of her life.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking, is like, to what lengths will she go to keep Vision in her life, and what repercussions will that have? I mean, especially if it's based on her powers and tearing holes in the multiverse. Do you have any thoughts on this?
She could be pretty nasty.
That would be actually an amazing way to take it, because again, it adds some flavor to her character. Her character, by the way, when we meet her in Age of Ultron, I guess, right? And she's already experienced a bunch of trauma in regards to that kind of setup. So I don't know that we've seen her deal with any of that. It'd be real interesting to see her kind of revert to that villain through this process of losing vision and then having that trauma guide her to do things, perhaps with what you might call the dark arts or something, which then you'd have a good setup for Doctor Strange to go, look, that's really not the way we do things around here. And then instant conflict. So that would be fascinating.
Of course, if that's how she does end up getting vision back, and if he does return to the MCU, I mean, her getting a hard lesson, you know, from, you know, speaking with him that, you know, this is not the kind of person I wanted you to be. Like, you're better than this. You know, that, of course, could be an interesting statement on how sometimes, you know, dealing with grief in a wrong way can, you know, kind of betray the person you're grieving.
Okay. And Vision would be the guy to say something like that to her, you know, where she might actually listen. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's back up just a tiny bit and just talk about the future of the MCU, starting from the point that we're at now, right? Which is post Spider-Man Home, Spider-Man Far From Home. Hey, everybody. I just wanted to pause here because while I was editing this episode, some potentially major Spider-Man news just hit the fan. Do you like Spider-Man?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. My son, ladies and gentlemen. All right. If you heard the news that came out today, which is Tuesday when I'm recording this, don't panic. This is not over yet. Anyway, we're going to do a short bonus episode after this weekend. It's going to be about today's Spider-Man news, plus any updates that happen over the weekend, and the MCU news that we anticipate is coming out of D23, which is also this weekend. So make sure to check out our bonus minisode next week for those updates. Okay, buddy, say bye to everybody.
Bye.
Say it into here. Say bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, back to the show. So this is what they've announced. The Black Widow movie is coming out May 1st, 2020, directed by Kate Shortland. The writer on that is Jack Schaefer, starring Scarlett Johansson, Florence Pugh as Yelena Belova, Rachel Weisz is in it, and David Harbour is in it.
Hmm.
Now, I heard some rumors that this was going to take place chronologically between Civil War and Infinity War, possibly with some flashbacks to her earlier years. But I don't think we really know a whole lot about it, though they did at San Diego Comic-Con show a fight scene between Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow and Florence Pugh, who are supposedly, I'm going to make air quotes here, sisters.
Hmm.
And then David Harbour is supposedly playing
Hellboy, right?
Right, right. No. Alexei.
He's reprising his role.
A.K.A. the Red Guardian, who I guess was kind of the Soviet Union's answer to Captain America. And David Harbour hasn't been able to say that much about the role, but he did say, and I quote, Alexei, he's a tremendously flawed guy and also has tremendous humor and tremendous heart. That's extremely vague, but that is the only information that I have about it at this time. And Rachel Weisz, I think, also said that the film is going to introduce more than one Black Widow. So that's really interesting. So we're going to get that. And then fall of 2020 on Disney Plus, we're getting The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And the showrunner on this is Malcolm Spellman. And Daniel Brühl is supposed to return as Baron Zemo. And he's actually going to put on that purple mask from the comics, apparently.
Daniel Brühle.
Yep. After that, we get The Eternals, November 6th, 2020, directed by Chloe Zhao. I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly. I'm sorry. Written by Matthew Furpo and Ryan Furpo. Starring Angelina Jolie as Thena, Richard Madden as Icarus, Kumail Nanjiani as Kingo. I love him.
Huh.
Lauren Ridloff as Makari. Brian Tyree Henry as Fastos. Selma Hayek, Lisa McHugh as Sprite. And Don Lee as Gilgamesh. Now, some of these roles apparently have been gender swapped. Like, Hayek is playing a character named Ajak, who originally, I guess, was the male leader of the Eternals. And I've also heard some rumblings that this movie is going to be based, at least in part, on the run of the Eternals comics that was written by Neil Gaiman.
Ooh.
And real quick here, I actually want to give a shout out to Eric. I want to give a shout out to Eric because Eric wrote a great article on the recent Amazon Prime show Good Omens, which of course is by the based on the book written by Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. And Eric, did I see properly that Neil Gaiman like made a comment on social media that your article was great?
Oh yeah, like I kind of wrote it in response to a lot of these Christian fundamentalists saying the show was like blasphemous, and spoiler alert, I'm actually a very religious guy. I loved that show. I thought it was amazing. I thought the humor was spot on. I thought it had some really good values about, you know, redemption and, you know, freedom of free will and all, everything like that. So I wrote this article, which kind of started off looking like it was going to be like a fundamentalist whining about the show. And then I ended the first paragraph saying, by the way, the show's amazing. Here's why it's actually a really good show, and every Christian all over the world should see it immediately. And I tweeted it at Neil Gaiman, and I said, I really liked the show. It really spoke to me on a personal level, and, you know, I thought it was great. And, yeah, he actually, you know, replied to it, and he said, you know, the article was terrific, and we actually got a fair amount of traffic that day. So
what a classy guy.
I actually have that tweet hanging on my bedroom door.
Whenever
I doubt my writing abilities, I just look at that tweet and say, you know, Neil Gaiman liked this article I wrote. Maybe I got something going on. So, you know.
That's fantastic. Cool. Yeah, I just wanted to quickly That's mention awesome. That because I saw that one day and I was like, oh, Eric, way to go, man. So anyway. So after The Eternals, we get Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, February 12th.
I don't know what that's about. Never heard of that.
Well, you know, and I guess at Comic-Con, they showed this, like, clips from a whole bunch of MCU movies where they had seeded in just, like, little glimpses of people, like, in the Ten Rings. And there was even, like, somebody in Ant-Man with, like, a Ten Rings tattoo on. So that's kind of interesting. Director Destin Daniel Cretton, writer Dave Callahan, and it's starring Simu Liu as Shang-Chi, Tony Leung as the real Mandarin, and... Someone named Awkwafina, whom I'm not terribly familiar with. So then, of course, WandaVision, Spring 2021, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, May 7th, 2021, which we've talked about a little bit already. Followed up by, in Spring 2021, Loki. Showrunner for that, Michael Waldron, starring Tom Hiddleston. Now, they did confirm that this is going to star the Loki from Endgame, who picked up the Tesseract, right?
Good.
And, okay, so maybe let's just talk about Loki for a second. I don't know if you guys have heard much about this, but there are some people that are saying that they're leaking information about it, and I have no clue whether this is all correct, right? But you know that Thor Love and Thunder is coming up in November of 2021, and we know that Natalie Portman is returning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that she's going to wield Mjolnir. First of all, how is Mjolnir going to come back in the first place, right? Well, some people are saying this is going to come from the Loki show because supposedly he's going to be using this Tesseract and he's going to be in this alternate timeline where Mjolnir is still there. And somehow he's going to end up causing mischief throughout humanity's history. And there is some concept art.
As is his wont.
Right. They showed to the Disney shareholders this concept art of Loki in the 1970s on Earth. So there's some indications that he will be traveling.
Please tell me he wears disco pants.
I certainly hope so. So I don't know, you know, it could be either that it's following his earlier life up to the present, but I think it makes more sense that he's traveling through time somehow, because some of these leaks are saying that he's going to be changing historical events. Now, I don't really know what to think about that, but I think that there is some reason to believe that he will be the source of Mjolnir in the new Thor movie. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I guess if he got it from his own, you know, he's in his own timeline, so he's in his own area where Mjolnir still exists, because there's also the question of what happened to Mjolnir after Cap went back in time. You know, he brought a shield back for, what's his face? Sam. But why didn't he bring back Mjolnir? Because he was certainly done with it. You know what I mean?
You mean Captain America?
So, yeah, at the end of Endgame.
Well, he did. I mean, he picked it up and he took it back in time with him. And one assumes that when he returned the Reality Stone to Asgard, he just dropped it off.
Well, one can assume all sorts of things, and that just turns you into one of me.
Yes.
An ass.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, is this something that you guys are interested in speculating on, Jay and Eric?
Well, let's see. I haven't read up a lot on a lot of the press, so I really have no opinions as of now. Because I like to I stopped reading up on a lot of press when it came to movies, because I find that if I get too hyped up, I usually get disappointed. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to go into the movie cold. That's what I like to do now. So I probably wouldn't be the best person to ask about that.
Okay, that's fine.
As far as I'm concerned, the thing about utilization of time travel, because we've seen it a lot recently. We've seen a lot of franchises start to incorporate time travel to some degree. And the issue is you've got rules on top of rules that are governing like how the time travel is going to work. And if you're not really careful, now, if you're going to trust anybody, Kevin Feige overseeing all this stuff is the person to trust. But at the same time, as soon as you introduce some of these things, I go, man, that's rough, because you're going to mess with a lot of stuff that's going to create like a lot of different scenarios that I'm not sure you can capitalize on. So I think I would go into it with a little bit more trepidation. I do think it's fascinating if he's traveling through time, messing with timelines. That's a good place for Loki to be, because it makes it, you know, it makes a character who is kind of been kind of a foil for Thor, it turns him into kind of a foil for the human race, which is kind of interesting. But other than that, I it does make me a little nervous, I think, that we might see more time travel aspects.
It does make me nervous as well. Yeah.
It's like they just had this whole thing in Endgame where they, you know, were just barely by the skin of their teeth, by the luck of the footstep of one rat, you know, able to find a way to make time travel work, you know, using the Pym particles. So if Loki's doing his own time traveling,
right,
how's he doing it, you know?
Right.
Is he,
well, that's
are they
the question.
Are they just stealing stuff from Endgame? Did he, you know, get Pym particles and go back, get more Pym particles, do this and that? I don't know. Loki's one of my favorite characters in the MCU. I think he's played fantastically by Tom Hiddleston, and I just love, I love his character because he's a slimy little dirtbag, and he reminds me a lot of me, so I can connect and relate. So I have a, you know,
yeah,
a lot of love for that guy.
I since you brought up the rat, I just want to mention real quick, the last time I went to go see Endgame in the theater, that moment when the rat like steps on the button and Scott comes out, like one guy in the back of the theater starts clapping. It's like, yeah, woo! You know, when the rat comes on.
And
that was great.
And real quick, in the commentary, the Russo brothers even did introduce it as the true hero of the end of the saga.
They did.
Introduced the rat. And they also said, is this the last we'll see of the rat?
No, you know what would be great? You know what would be amazing? What if the rat was Loki?
If the rat was, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? And we see that in
that
the show.
That would make so much sense.
It would be. Because why would Loki be sniffing around on a van dashboard in a dumpster?
Oh, maybe he was trying to help out after he realized Thanos offed him.
Right?
He was just a hungry rat trying to get a nut.
That would actually make quite a bit of sense. And, you know, we've established that he can turn himself into animals and things. So
I think it would have been better if the van was in a more forested location and it was a squirrel, thus the intro for Squirrel Girl.
There you go.
The unbeatable Squirrel
Girl. Who we are all clamoring to see on screen, of course.
I'd love to see Squirrel Girl on screen. But okay,
if it's played by Anna Kendrick.
Yeah, I think she's done like cosplay of Squirrel Girl, right? And she looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a couple other things left in terms of the future of the MCU that I want to kind of announce, and then we can talk about a couple details. And then I actually want to revisit the time travel thing and talk to Jay about his book. But, you know, they're doing this in summer of 2021. They're doing this Marvel's What If show, which is actually an animated series. And I think this is hearkening back. They did like a comic series, right, where it was like What If, and they would take like some little detail from the main continuity and tweak it a little bit. And the interesting thing, the most interesting thing to me about this show is the fact that for the voice actors, they're actually using the actors from the live action movies.
Right.
So that's really interesting. Hawkeye is coming fall of 2021, the show on Disney Plus. It looks like it's going to introduce Kate Bishop and is going to be based on Matt Fraction's Hawkeye comic series, which is like kind of amazing, that Hawkeye series. I don't know if you guys have read it, but it's definitely worth giving a look if you like reading comics. And then, of course, we have Thor Love and Thunder, which we talked about a little bit. Now, they also have talked about some other things that are happening. they just haven't talked about like what the scheduling looks like or many of the details. So for example, Blade, they're going to be doing Blade, and Blade is going to be played by Academy Award winner, and I'm so sorry, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of his name, Mahershala.
You always do.
Yes, Mahershala Ali, who was actually Cottonmouth in the Luke Cage show on Netflix.
And he was also what's his face in Alita Battle Angel.
Yeah, that's right. He was in that as well. Now, something interesting, and I read in the Hollywood Reporter, Kevin Feige said that Ali called them after he won his Oscar for Green Book. And Feige said, when Mahershala calls, you answer. And I guess at the right. meeting that they set up out of that call, he came right out and said that he wanted to do Blade. And according to the Hollywood Reporter, that was that. So that's just not a way that these things normally happen, I don't think. And so that just kind of was noteworthy to me. Obviously, they're doing a Black Panther sequel. Obviously, they're doing the third Guardians of the Galaxy, which, Jay, you may know this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't they originally going to do the third Guardians movie like as the first movie after Endgame before they fired and rehired James Gunn? Do you know anything about that?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I bet you my other co-host, Daryl, would know the answer to that. He knows all that kind of stuff, but I don't remember. I do remember that it was sort of one of those things that was on the top of everybody's minds. Like, oh, well, what's going to happen with Guardians 3 next? But then they had the whole James Gunn thing. He moved over to Suicide Squad, and it was like, now we have no clue what's going to happen.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. I thought it was interesting that I think you'll have to check with Daryl, but I think originally that was going to be, you know, maybe even before Spider-Man Far From Home. But anyway, So then we're going to have Captain Marvel 2 at some point. And beyond that, it's mostly speculation, okay? San Diego Comic-Con, Feige just, like, hinted in the briefest possible way about the Fantastic Four and Mutants or X-Men. There's no way they're not going to come back to those franchises. I think it's reasonable to say that, but I really hope that they give it some space before they do that, especially with the X-Men, personally. Just because we've had so much of the X-Men up until, you know, this summer. Now, Deadpool,
I'm sure it's all going to be a reboot anyway, so.
It has to be. I mean, I think it really has to be. But let's just talk about Deadpool for a second, because right after Disney, the whole acquisition thing finished, what was it, this spring or something? Bob Iger gave this big presentation to, you know, basically all the people at Disney, and he said that they're definitely going to do more with Deadpool. Variety reported that Disney and Marvel Studios is grappling with how to fit the very R-rated Deadpool into its PG-13 rated Marvel Cinematic Universe. The goal is to find a way for the character to move seamlessly between Avengers spinoffs and the bloody, profane standalone adventures, end quote from Variety.
Breaking the fourth wall and all that too.
Right. You know? So, I mean, that makes sense. Like, how do you balance Deadpool with having him in a PG-13, you know, Avengers movie or, you know, other movie? There have been some rumors. There's a rumor that Deadpool will be introduced to the MCU in the end credit scene of Black Widow. Mm-hmm. There have been some rumors that Ryan Reynolds did sign a new contract with Disney Marvel. Rumors that he'll be part of the new Avengers. And some rumors that he'll team up with Daredevil. I don't know what to think about all those, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was in an end credit scene for Black Widow or Eternals or something.
Speaking of Daredevil, I'm wondering what Disney's plans are with the Daredevil and Punisher we had from Netflix, if there's any plans at all to bring those two back, because those shows were fantastic.
I think all we know for sure is that they have to wait 2 years before using them in anything, because that was the deal that they had with Netflix.
Okay.
But I don't think there's any way that they're going to use the same actors from those shows.
I wish they would.
I just don't think there's too much. I don't know how much you guys know about this, but like the guy who ran the Marvel TV shows was not Kevin Feige, and the guy that ran the Marvel TV shows was not in charge of the MCU. They had some differences.
Right.
And so I really don't think that's going to be the case. Plus, then they'd have to deal with all this stuff.
Disney's got them Benjamins, yo. Disney's got that money.
Well, they do. Honey. They do have the Benjamins. So, but how do you guys feel about Deadpool and the mutants coming into the MCU? Do you have hopes and dreams? Are you just over it? Like, do you have any thoughts about how it might happen? What are your thoughts on that, Eric?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'd like to see the mutants kind of incorporated into the MCU with the kind of like aesthetic that the main series has established. Because, I mean, I'm actually not the biggest fan of, you know, the caped superhero genre, but I really do enjoy the MCU movies because they have a lot of personality and humanity to them, whereas a lot of other superhero stuff, you know, seems to kind of fall into the, you know, fantasy of power, you know, area of cinema. But, I mean, I'd really like to see just how they could incorporate these characters and have them interact, you know, with the main series because, I mean, Deadpool is obviously so different. The X-Men series deals with themes that I find very fascinating, and to see those dealt with in the context of the main Marvel universe, I think could be a real treat, you know, kind of see them, how they play off of each other.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on this, Jay?
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I in many regards, I have always been a much bigger fan of the X-Men and the themes that the X-Men have dealt with as opposed to the Avengers. It's just that, you know, we got these amazing Avengers movies with the MCU and we got kind of spotty movies with Fox and the X-Men. So I think to see someone like Kevin Feige oversee the X-Men sounds amazing. I don't know how you deal with the Deadpool problem because Disney is a very, in 2019, Disney is a very manicured company. They're not doing a lot of things that are pushing the envelope. In fact, you could argue that despite the fact that they're doing all of this and putting out all this amazing content, they're really doing it all for money. I mean, like they only produce stuff that they make money on. They don't take a lot of big risks. It's not something that Disney's doing. In fact, you see all these live action remakes they're doing. I mean, that's just almost just like printing money for them because they're just taking properties that everybody loves and going, here it is again, just with like, you know, humans. You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a bad thing as long as the film itself comes out well, because a lot of people don't know this, but Casablanca, that was not a movie made by people who are passionate at all. That was a cookie-cutter movie done exclusively for profit. And, you know, the fact that it survived this long, you know, shows that it kind of grew beyond the purpose it was initially made for.
But is that the exception more than the rule, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think Disney's still putting out some pretty good content when they do new stuff. Like, I'm not into the live-action remake thing at all. I didn't even bother to see the new Lion King because I've already seen the movie. I mean, what's the point? It's like seeing Gus Van Sant's Psycho. What's the point? You know, so... But I do think that even though a lot of their work is profit-driven, they still are doing it a lot better than most studios have done in the past because they are still putting out good content even if they aren't taking as many risks as they probably should be.
Well, yeah, they have the time and money to put into to make sure they get the talent to put out quality product, totally. Well,
I've also heard that Disney and Bob Iger has really been giving Feige pretty much free rein just because of how wildly successful Marvel Studios movies have been.
Even if the studio is not passionate about it, the people working on it are passionate about it. I think that shows.
Yeah. I think my point being, like, I'm excited for Disney to get their hands on a lot of different things. I think what it does, though, it doesn't get us alternate takes. And so what you had with Deadpool specifically, and I'm not even a big Deadpool fan particularly, so as I say this, I'm like, I'd be fine with a Disney take on Deadpool. I'm just not sure how many hardcore Deadpool fans would be cool with a Disney take on Deadpool. And I don't think Disney's going to push that line the way that, I guess it was Fox, right? Fox pushed that line. So we'll see, I guess. I guess that's where I'm kind of like, oh, okay, well, I might be okay with it. Is everybody else going to be okay with it?
I think they're still going to do R because I think they know that's where the audience wants. They don't want to piss off the audience and lose them.
And Deadpool 1 was the highest grossing R-rated movie ever, I think, right?
Yeah, it's the same thing. A lot of people were worried about, you know, the fact that Disney acquired the rights to the Alien and the Predator series, that they were going to kind of dumb that down. And I'm thinking, Disney, they know the fandom isn't going to go for that. They're not going to want to alienate the fan base. So I still expect the next Alien movie that comes out, hopefully it'll be good, but it'll certainly be bloody.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, too. Like, back to the X-Men thing first. Like Eric mentioned, they do they have touched on seemingly more political issues and themes in their shows, like the mutants, you know, viewed through the lens of racism and stuff. And not all the X-Men movies were great, but the X-Men have always been my favorite group in the comics. So I can't wait till they come to the MCU. I'm really looking forward to it. Even if they bring, I don't know, the new X-Men, the younger folk, because a lot of those are great actors and they do great parts in their roles. Or if they recast with all new, I'm still in it. I love mutants. I love that take on it. And as far as the Deadpool thing, you know, at the end of Infinity War, everybody gasped when Samuel L. Jackson said, "Muff," you know, and almost dropped the first F-bomb. And bringing Deadpool into the world where you almost have an F-bomb, where, you know, 5 minutes into one of his movies, there's dead bodies everywhere, sometimes in pieces, you know, it will be interesting to see how they bring him into the MCU.
Did anybody see the Once Upon a Deadpool PG-13 version?
Yes.
He like kidnaps Frank Savage.
Ridiculous.
Fred Savage. Was it still? I mean, because I didn't see it, but I feel like that was their attempt to be like, look, we can be a Disney movie.
You know, I'd have to watch it again. I didn't see the whole thing, but I did love the whole Princess Bride take they took on it, because right. They redid all the shots, rebuilt the bedroom. Fred Savage was wearing the same clothing, you know, with the same decorations there. It was a really funny approach to it. But I can't really remember. I'd have to see the two side by side to see exactly what was cut out.
Yeah. Well, I feel like Deadpool in a way is kind of the linchpin for Marvel bringing in the mutants, because they already know that they're doing stuff with Deadpool, even if they don't know exactly right. What form that's going to take. And Deadpool is a mutant. I don't think there's any getting around that.
No.
And he's so connected to the mutants and the X-Men. He at least, you know, in the sense that he has to inhabit that same mutant world as them. And so I wouldn't be surprised if whenever they bring in Deadpool, that's kind of their, you know, the beginnings of them bringing in the, you know, the mutants and the X-Men into the MCU. That's quite interesting. But so, okay, so I just want
to
talk.
It'll be interesting to see how Deadpool himself changes, because his character can't be exactly the same with the breaking the fourth wall all the time.
I don't know. I think the fact that he breaks the fourth wall all the time is not only integral to his character, but that's sort of what makes him the best candidate for actually bringing him over from that other universe, you know? I mean, if you could do that with anybody.
I just don't know how that would work in like an ensemble movie, like the New Avengers or whatever. That's like Thanos snapping his fingers and looking at the camera and saying, "That'll get him," you know?
I don't know.
Be a little silly.
I think they can figure it out. So I just want to talk real quick about something. So first of all, since we're on Deadpool, I really love the post-credit stuff at the end of Deadpool 2, where he uses the time machine to go back and like change all this stuff. Because because that's like the thing with any time travel movie where there's always somebody like, well, why don't you just use the time machine and go back and make all the bad things not happen?
Didn't he kill a baby, though?
Oh, yeah, he supposedly, like, killed baby Hitler in a deleted scene.
Oh.
just goes up to Hitler's crib, just blows him away with a Glock or something.
Oh, my God.
It's like, didn't he kill a baby? Yeah, but it was Hitler. Oh, that's cool then.
But it's just kind of that you know, that middle finger to the, sort of what's expected that, you know, is the kind of thing that I love about Deadpool.
Exactly.
So, speaking of time travel,
everybody loved was the X-Men Origins Wolverine scene where he just murdered not Deadpool. Like everybody was looking for that. Yeah,
yeah. That was warranted. That was definitely warranted.
Yeah. That was terrible Deadpool.
But speaking of time travel, so I think, you know, they didn't spend too much time explaining how it worked in Endgame, but it was kind of...
Oh, real quick. Sorry. I was thinking of this earlier before we get on to the time travel thing, and we're kind of still in the future of the MCU. One thing I was thinking of earlier was, what about the snap? Like, all these new shows and stuff that are coming out, do you think they're going to show us more, you know, scenes of the snappening, the blip, whatever you want to call it? Do you think that might be part of the way some of these shows start? Or scenes
Maybe.
Will incorporate into these shows?
I think they're going to have to explore the post-blip, you know, universe. But
yeah, because as far as the snap, we got to see the effects of it on screen for about, I don't know, 45 seconds to a minute 15 seconds, but it totally decimated a lot of things, and I think it would change the world going into the future, and we'd have to see more scenes of that. And also, where were at least half of the remaining villains during this time? You know what I mean? It's like half the police force in Detroit's gone. Now these villains are like, aha! You would think there'd be some stuff going on, but they didn't touch it on that at all in Endgame, and I know why.
Well,
but
there just there has wasn't to be a time, whole, you know?
A whole universe of stories, you know, in that 5-year period that could be touched on.
I don't think they're gonna go. I mean, I would be surprised if they went into that 5-year period because we're beyond that now. I mean, maybe a couple little things, but I guess is there any stuff that you guys want to see explored in terms of what this, you know, snap and unsnap means for the world and for the universe after that, before we get into the final thing, Jay and Eric, is there anything that you're kind of hoping to see developed in these later shows and movies?
Well, one of the things that I think would be interesting to see is, you know, how do, trying to find the right words, because you have a number of people who probably wouldn't have existed, like due to the snap. Like what if you had a couple, say, that was like cut in half by the snap? One person has vanished, the other person remains. Then this other person, you know, stays behind and falls in love with someone else, and then they're unsnapped and the original person comes back. So how do you deal with something like that? Like, those are the kinds of things that I think could be really interesting to address.
And there could be like heroes and villains created because of the snap for reasons like that. You know, there could be a lot of storylines that began at the snap, and I think that'd be kind of an interesting twist on some cool stories could come out of that.
Or maybe opportunities, like, say, I mean, if you get rid of half of the world's population, that's going to open up opportunities for some people. Like, and but then if you unsnap it, like, say somebody, you know, is able to take over at a company or an institution, you know, achieve their dream job because the original person was vanished, and then the original person comes back. What happens to the career that other person has been building over the course of 4 years? What types of conflicts,
right,
would be created as a result of, you know, this slingshot, essentially, of, you know, the universe's population? There's a number of really interesting things you can do that in and of themselves, yeah, would be worthy of making their own movie.
Yeah, but they're most likely going to get brushed under the carpet. But, I mean, it's like, if you really think about it, and I'm kind of stupid and do this from time to time, there's a lot of extra death toll that isn't people that got snapped. Like someone waiting for a replacement liver, you know, or something like that, and then their donor gets dusted.
Or you're on a plane and suddenly there's no pilot.
Yeah, 4 years, 364 days later, you die and your donor comes back the next day. You know, stuff like that.
Or what if there's a pilot who gets dusted and then they get brought back? Did they get brought back at the same location? Because if, right, they were flying a plane, because if they do...
Half the plane appears 35,000 feet above it. And that's the thing, the end scene really of Infinity... Yeah, the end scene of Infinity War, there's a helicopter dropping out of the sky, car crashes everywhere. That happened all over the planet. I mean, think of all the people in cars injured and killed in car accidents. And
yeah.
All sorts of things. Trains, planes, and automobiles.
I like to think that Professor Hulk would be thorough enough to say, okay, let's make sure that people who are significantly air just get brought down.
Yeah, and I think we covered that. We might have covered that in an earlier podcast, and
yeah, that's I'm on board with that idea. I think Hulk was thoughtful enough. So, so Jay, is there anything you're looking forward to being developed about this post-snap universe in the what's to come?
Well, I'd be pretty disappointed, and I don't know if they've confirmed this or not, but I'd be pretty disappointed if the Hawkeye series wasn't about his time spent as Ronin. That would be more compelling to me. I don't know. They talk about it. Yeah, you'd think so, right? Like, and they talked about Kate Bishop and him training Kate Bishop, and I'm like, well, I don't know if that's going to be Ronin days or non-Ronin days, but to me, that would be a fascinating show. So I think between Hawkeye and exploring his 5 years, and then exploring Wanda and her, whatever that looks like, 5 years, you know, multiverse stuff going on, I think those are the two ways I'd want to see it explored. And beyond that, I think maybe move on. I mean, despite the fact that it's such a significant event, I don't think we want to keep dwelling on it either. We want to see some new stuff happen. So
I agree, and I love your pitch for the Hawkeye show. Although I think maybe what would be great for that show is like almost like half and half flashbacks of him during his Ronin period versus where he is now, right?
Yeah, that could be
because
cool.
Okay, he's got his family back, right? But those 5 years still happened to him. He still went dark, right? And now he's got to reacclimate to being, you know, a father and a husband.
Absolutely, yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that's all going to be exciting. I mean, basically, Marvel has given me faith at this point that I'm just in for whatever they're going to show us. And I can't wait to see what
that is. Just weird that it's like Endgame led us to believe that for 5 years there was no superheroing or no supervillaining going on. Everyone was just kind of sitting around being sad. You know what I mean?
There definitely was sadness.
There's stories there.
Yeah, there's stories there. So I do want to pivot because I think we've really been thorough about talking about this. And I just want to talk briefly about time travel and bring that into the next thing that we're going to talk about. So they didn't spend a whole lot of time in Endgame talking about the mechanics of how their time travel would work, which I think was a good idea. but they, you know, they did mention, and the filmmakers have subsequently talked about how the way that it works is when you go back in time and you quote unquote change something, you basically create a branch timeline. It doesn't actually change your present or, you know, the future that you come from. So that's real interesting. And of course that, you know, leads into the Loki show and God knows what else, which is exciting. But Jay, you have written or co-written a book called Time Slingers, which has gotten some really amazing reviews. And I was hoping you could take some, you know, a little bit of time here and tell us about your book and about how you handled time travel in it, to the extent that you, you know, can talk about it without spoiling it or whatnot.
Yeah, no, definitely. I appreciate the question, too. Time travel is such a tricky thing. I mean, you've seen so many shows where they suddenly kind of got completely out of whack or jumped the shark entirely because the time travel just stopped working. And then you got other shows like, I mean, Doctor Who has been going on for how many years now? And so it's, you know, the way you handle the time travel, the rules that you set up, what your audience believes, their suspension of disbelief in certain areas is really important. And I do think that Endgame handled its time travel really, really well. And part of it is that I don't think you want to go into explanations that are so on the nose that you can get yourself in trouble. It's better to kind of leave it open to interpretation to a certain extent. And I think that they also covered, we know that we're going to deal with some multiverse of madness stuff when we talk about Doctor Strange. We're not sure if that means alternate timelines or not, but they did leave themselves open to, okay, we can actually collapse some of the timelines by having somebody go back in time and return the stones to where they were. We can make those timelines kind of go on in a better way, basically. So I think that they handled it really well. I think from my standpoint, and I'm sure Eric has read a bunch of scripts that had time travel in it too. But from my standpoint, you've got to do two things with a time travel story. You've got to set up the rules for how the world's going to work, and then you have to make sure that you'd break none of those rules for yourself. And the rules have to make sense. Like, for example, we have a rule in our story, which, by the way, you never read this, I don't think, in the entire book. We might have one paragraph that kind of goes into this, but we have a rule that says because we're opening up wormholes in order for the person to travel back through time. So we have a rule that says once that wormhole has been opened up, it can't be opened up again for a certain length of time. It's almost like it has a half-life to it. And the reason we have that rule is because it makes it instantly frustrating as a writer or a reader to realize, well, why don't they just, they screwed that up. Why don't they just go right back and fix it again? And then you just get into this battle of seconds of people going back and back and back and back and back. So I do think that you've got to have a set of rules. You've got to determine if there is going to be a multiple timelines or if there's going to be one major timeline that keeps changing. And all those are kind of instrumental into the story you're trying to tell and the implications of that story. So it's just a lot to think about. And you know, you really have to work on that suspension of disbelief so that the audience will go along with you.
Yeah. Especially when you're dealing with crazy things like time travel, you know, you want people to stay plugged into the story. Yeah.
Time travel is one of the most inherently difficult things to get across in fiction, but it's also one of the more creative because there's so much, you know, opportunities you know, to create some really fascinating stories. Obviously, my favorite time travel story is The Terminator. Love The Terminator.
Right.
Great story.
Me too. One of my favorites.
Yeah. I prefer the first one. A lot of people like the second one better. I like the first one.
I like them both a lot. So, Jay, what else can you – do you want to tell us about your book?
I just prefer the first one.
Well, just for the record, too, I also prefer the first Terminator, so we have some several people on there saying that.
All right.
I would say this. I would say if you're a person who likes – if you like comic books, then you'll probably love Time Slingers because we actually wrote it as a serial story. This was originally released – years and years ago as a serial story that we released on a blog. And then we said, you know what? This serial story now has an ending to it, and we'll go ahead and turn that into a novel. But of course, that creates some techniques that we use that I think a lot of comics fans and a lot of people who like to read really fast-paced novels will like, because we try to end every single chapter on a cliffhanger. So that you just have to kind of keep turning the page. And we do that on purpose because when it's a serial story, just like a comic book, you don't want to drop people, right? You want them to go, oh, yeah, I got to read the next section. And so I think as an audience member, that's really exciting. And a lot of people have said, like, wow, this is really fast-paced and it's really fun. So those are two of the comments that I've personally really enjoyed. It's also interesting because there are some people who go, oh, there are some deeper themes here. There are some people that go, oh, this seems kind of shallow. And the reason for that is because we're not forcing any themes on you, but we want the themes to be there if you go to explore it any deeper, right? So kind of themes about like, who's in your tribe? Who should be in your tribe? Should you break through your tribe and do something different? So we've got, you know, people that are characters who are tied to their government systems, or they're fighting against the government system. And we've also got characters who are very tied to the way that their government is operating. And yet they have family members that they can reconnect with. And so what should they do with that? Should they try to pursue the family member, or should they try to pursue their government tribe? And which loyalty basically is higher? So, I think it's been getting some, it's like at 4.5 out of 5 stars on Amazon right now from about 46 reviewers. And a lot of people have been really enjoying it. So if you like that kind of story, and especially if you have kids, this is another thing actually too, I'd say. If you have kids and you're trying to get them to do some more reading, but you've found it pretty difficult for them to like really dive into books, it's a great book for anybody like around age, you know, let's say 10 through 12, who's finding it really difficult to read because it's very fast paced. It's very high energy. And I think that they're more likely to stick with it in that way.
Oh, that's a really interesting thought. I hadn't considered that. Now, I did mention to you before we started recording that I picked up a copy myself, and I'm like, you know, maybe 20% of the way through it. But it's definitely very fast-paced, and I think the word that I used to describe it was propulsive.
Because, that's a good word. I like that.
Because it really just carries you along, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't let up. And, you know, at the end of every installment or every chapter, you know, I'm sitting there like, oh, my God, like, I just have to turn the page. So, you know, kudos on, you know, creating such a compelling story.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it's been really fun.
Ending chapters on cliffhangers, that's, you know, definitely a very... I mean, you treat it like episodes of the show. Each chapter is an episode. So you want to make sure you end an episode on a point that gets people hooked. You don't want to let them go. So that's actually a very excellent storytelling device to make sure you end your chapters on an emotional gut punch, so to speak.
Yeah, because you don't care if people go to sleep on time and are well rested for work the next day. You just want to get your story out there. And no, actually, it does sound fantastic. And I actually must admit, I did just purchase a copy 4 minutes ago.
Nice.
On Amazon. And also, for our listeners, if you're wondering the best way to get this, open up Google, type in Time Slingers. It is the number one result.
Nice.
You can find it as the first result on Google. Can't go wrong. And I don't have a review for you yet.
Jay, you have made it to the top of the Google search engine. How do you feel about that?
Oh, it feels good. Yeah, that's awesome. I know that there is actually there's a film called Time Slingers, of all things. And if you search for that, you can find the film on there on Amazon too. But I've never seen it. I have no way of endorsing that. It is not affiliated with us. We had the name far before they did. So Just right fair on. Warning.
I even did my first search on Yahoo, and you come up number one result on audible.com, which you're also available at.
That's right. Yeah. It's me. It's me. Oh, you have to listen to me read the book to you, but.
Yeah. Oh, is it your voice narrating it too then, Jay?
It is. Yeah. I have. So because we do the Story Geeks podcast all the time, I have all this, you know, audio equipment now, and I go, oh, I can release an audio book. It's now granted, I had to take some lessons from my voice actor friends and make sure that I, you know, got it right. But yeah, you can listen to me.
You got to breathe in the right time.
That's right. That's right.
That's great. Well, why don't you tell us and, you know, all our listeners where they can pick up Time Slingers?
Yeah, well, like Jess just said, you can go on to Amazon. It's available on Audible. So if you want to listen to me read it to you, it is available on Kindle. We still have a special price going on right now, so don't wait too long on it. You can get it on Kindle for 99 cents right now, which is pretty phenomenal. And then if you prefer like print books, or like I said, if you want to hand it to your kid and you'd rather have them do a print book, we've got it available on print as well. If you search Amazon for Time Slingers, you'll find that other movie and you'll find ours. So just like make sure you select ours. And there you go.
Great.
Yeah, you haven't filmed your movie yet.
Not yet. No. In fact, most people have told us that it would make a really good TV show. So that's one of the things we're thinking about doing is pitching it to a network of some sort at some point.
You got to write the pilot.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. I really need to.
That's fantastic.
Have Eric check it out before we go into production, you know?
Oh, I read a lot absolutely. Of TV pilots.
Awesome. But that's one thing with time travel. It's like we've all been so inundated with it throughout our lives. If we were ever in a position in our lives where we need to figure out time travel to fix this problem, I think all of us might be able to kind of MacGyver a way through it and make it happen with all the different options we've been fed, you know, through movies and TV. And
the collective consciousness of humanity has certainly pondered the question enough.
It's coming,
one might say. So I think we're coming to the end of the episode here, so I just want to start to wrap up by asking everybody here if you have any last thoughts on Endgame or the future of the MCU or time travel that maybe you didn't get a chance to say, or something that's occurred to you, or just something that's really playing on your mind. Jess, do you have anything that you want to impart about all that?
Oh, what to say that hasn't already been said? No, like we've covered earlier, Endgame is not the end. It's nowhere near the end. This is only the beginning of phase 4 of the MCU, and they're, you know, with Disney and their service coming out, they're seeming to take on more of the shows involving more of the main characters, and it'll be real interesting to see how that plays out, because there's a lot you can do, you know, even if it's only 8 or 10 episodes per season. If you're working in an hour long episode, you can work in a lot of story throughout the season. So it's really cool to see what character development is coming, where the stories are going, and what's coming next over the hill. So I'm on board. Can't wait.
Great. Jay?
Yeah, it's kind of I feel the same way. I mean, we've talked about almost all of the MCU movies, I feel like, at this point on our podcast. And so we're just very invested in this franchise, in this universe they're creating. And I think it's in really good hands. There's very few MCU films I don't like. And I'm excited for what comes next, because I think they're going to keep hitting out of the park. So we'll see.
Yeah, great. Eric?
I think the best way to end a story is to begin another one. And that's the way I felt, you know, Endgame drew to a close, because it was a good send-off to the characters that introduced the MCU, while at the same time leaving the door open for new characters to kind of take up the mantle and go on their own adventure and face their own Thanos. Honestly, I would be perfectly satisfied if this was the last MCU movie they ever made, because it feels like a good conclusion, whereas, you know, from what I understand, Far From Home feels like a kind of like nice little epilogue to the original series. But yeah, I mean, I was very happy with this film. And I'm interested in seeing, you know, the new dynamic and the new team they're going to put together with characters like Captain Marvel and the person who's going to be taking up the mantle for Captain America, and of course Spider-Man, who's going to be taking up the mantle for Tony Stark. And, you know, how are they going to deal with the pressures of, you know, measuring up to the people they've left behind? And those are themes that I find really interesting. So yeah, you know, I'm really excited in seeing, you know, what's going to come next. But at the same time, I could leave it here and, you know, be perfectly happy with leaving it where it's ended.
Yeah.
Cuz you know they've ended a story, but at the same time they've begun another interesting one. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. I'm interested.
Yeah.
Well, hang on to your butts.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely in for whatever comes next. I don't think I could say, you know, I don't think I could say it any more eloquently than you gentlemen just have. So I think I'll probably leave it there.
Real quick.
Oh, yes.
I didn't get a chance to say this, but I have a very funny relationship with Paul Rudd because before Ant-Man, the only movie I saw him in was Halloween 6.
He's your father.
So he's always going to be Halloween 6 guy to me.
That's funny.
That's hilarious.
Apparently,
you know what? I gotta say, I really enjoy Paul Rudd as Ant-Man, and I do wish. You know what? I do have a final thought on all of this. As much as I love Endgame, there's just two little tiny things that I wish we could have seen in it. Aside from, I guess the Hulk transformation really would have been its own movie, but I really wish that Scott would have been a little tiny bit more involved in the planning of the time heist. I mean, he had some funny moments in there, but that's his thing, right? Is planning a heist and enacting a heist. So I would have loved to see that. And number two.
Yeah, Scott's one of my favorite characters. He's so funny.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I don't know if you guys noticed, but during the Ant-Man movies, when his friend is kind of like talking about, you know, these flashbacks, they're actually playing the soundtrack from a 1970s Pam Grier movie called Coffee. I don't know if you guys have ever seen Coffee.
No, wow. I haven't. That's great. Yeah, thanks for that factoid. Yeah, that's awesome. So the last thing for me is that one of the things that I really wanted to see just a tiny bit more of in Avengers Endgame, and I'm not even talking about a whole scene. I'm just talking about like one little story beat, is the connection that developed between Tony and Nebula when they were stranded on that ship for like 3 weeks after the snap. Now, like I said, I'm not talking about a whole scene or anything because they already had so much to do in that. But just like a look where they like look at each other. Like Tony comes by and like...
After they got off the ship, did they even speak to each other through the rest of the movie?
Not outside of a group setting where they were all sort of contributing to the plan. But I mean, even if it was just like Tony walked by her and put his hand on her arm, I don't know, you know, something. Just, that relationship was always really intriguing to me. And Nebula's become one of my favorite characters in the MCU at this point. I mean, she's come so far and she's been through so much. And, you know, anyhow, everything that you guys said, I agree with. But those are my last 2 cents, little things that I kind of wanted to mention. But I just want to end by thanking both of you, Jay and Eric, for coming on our little podcast to talk to us about these things. And actually, Eric, can you just tell us really quick where interested parties can find your work online, your articles and things?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I used to work for a magazine called Movie Pilot, and they ended up folding at least the part of the program that I was in. But a couple of friends of mine, you know, who, you know, we met while working together at Movie Pilot, we formed a little online magazine. It's called Screen Hub Entertainment, and it's been going on since 2018. We're not doing too bad, actually. I think we get usually about 60,000 views a year, which isn't terrible by any stretch.
Not too shabby.
But yeah, you can definitely check out, you know, Screen Hub Entertainment. You know, the web address is screenhub.blog. It uses WordPress, and we're coming out with articles on a weekly basis. My articles are pretty easy to find. You know, they set up little pages for each author. So if you want to view content from a specific author, it's pretty easy to navigate there. And I tend to do you know, not only reviews of contemporary films, but also, you know, critical analysis and retrospectives on older films like Ghostbusters, First Blood, etc. Screenhub.blog, you know, Screenhub Entertainment, you know, feel free to check it out at any time. We're always, you know, eager to build our audience. And, you know, I work for International Screenwriters Association, so for any of you fledgling writers out there looking to, you know, have your work evaluated and, you know, see, you know, areas that you can improve on or where your strengths lie. You know, we're always looking for submissions. Who knows? I might be the guy to review your script and hopefully not crush your dreams. We'll see.
Hopefully. Great.
Who knows? I might be the next guy to submit something. I want to get my writing out there. It's about time.
Well, I'll make sure to put that link and information about the Story Geeks and the link to your book, Jay, on our show notes. You know, the little details under the podcast episode. So thanks again, guys, for being here. We really appreciate you coming on to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, and, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, I'd absolutely. Thanks for having me. Again for more movies. You know, this is a great
all
time.
Right. Yeah, we'll have to definitely do that. So, Jess, why don't you give our listeners the deets on our social media, and we'll sign out.
All right, Poindexters. Once again, thanks to our guests, Jay and Eric. Hopefully you check them out as you're busy checking us out. And you can do that very easily by following us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Caster,
Anchor,
CastBox, and Stitcher. Anywhere you listen to your podcasts. We're also on Facebook as Mecha Dragon and on Twitter and Instagram at Mecha Dragon Show. We love to hear from you guys. Give us ideas on what you want us to talk about, things you'd want us to cover, guests we might need. And thanks a lot. Peace out.
Thanks, everybody. It's Captain Will signing off. Take care. Our music is Overworld and Furious Freak by Kevin MacLeod. From Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0.